Hello, friends. Welcome to the Neighborhood Church Podcast. You can go to neighborhoodchurchmn.org to get more information on how you can get even better connected. Have a good and beautiful day. Enjoy.
How you guys doing?
Doing good. All right.
Well, my name's Chris. I am one of the lead pastors here. My wife is at a basketball tournament down in La Crosse. She had to drive through the storm, and she can do hard things. And I just found out that ESCO, right, that's where my kids go to school, they made it to the Final Four in their state championship tournament. So he's like, thank you for all pretending to care. I really like that. They're like, we got to clap, make Chris feel good. So we're in a series called Orthodoxy, Orthodox, and that is a word that doesn't get it like really pumped up around here, right? It's not like you go to wife like, hey honey, I'm really Orthodox, how you feeling, right? They're gonna be like, you are having a seizure, I think. So it's a word that doesn't bring up a lot of emotion, but it's a critically important word because Orthodox means something that is tried and true, something that has been well established as followers of Jesus, or even just our culture, says something new, hip, width, and wow, cutting edge. And we kind of, at times, will reject something older, and we think it's outdated. But part of our stream, part of our faith tradition, we have to hold on to some old Orthodox beliefs because it keeps us moving forward in who God is calling us to be. Last week, we talked about Trinity, about being able to step into that flow of that radical, life-giving love. And today, we talk about me taking a trip halfway across the country. I know, that's what you're thinking. So it was like 10:15, 10:30. And if you've ever like texted with me and it's after 9:30, I usually don't make a lot of sense, right? Nothing really good happens in my life. I get tired like around, not anyone else like 9:30, like you're ready to go to bed? Yeah, that's my story. So it was like 10:15, and of course, I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm watching TV, but I'm also watching something on my phone, like a sports game, all right? And then a sports game. I'm so old. You guys want to watch a sports game with me? So, and then I have like some social media on my TV. So I'm like, of course, doing too many things at once. I'm exhausted. And this was in the fall. And one of my friends posted like a last ditch effort, like, hey, I need some help. Can you drive one of our vehicles halfway across the country? Like tomorrow. And I saw that and something inside of me said, yeah, I should do that. Actually, I'm going to do that. And so I text this my friend and I said, I'm on it. They're like, you're gonna be gone for like 3 or 4 days. I said, no problem, it's gonna be totally fine. And when I said it's gonna be totally fine, something in the back of my head said, this might not be totally fine. So knowing that, I already committed to it. I'm all in, right? I'm excited. And I text my wife. Because this is, yeah, Lori knows my wife, right? So I Nikki's in the other room, right? But I text her. And I said, hey, I'm leaving for 4 days tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure this is like right around, right when school is starting too, right? And as I'm typing, I'm like, what am I doing, right? What kind of moron am I? And she comes, I send it, I'm like, maybe she's like, wow, I'm really proud of you. Way to take risks, Chris. Instead, she came in and she said, what? I make sure I. I almost happened, friends. Almost happened. She said, "What is wrong with you?" All right, and it was like just it was confronted with it, and she literally said like she stopped. She was like, "What were you thinking by going across halfway across the country, leaving me with the kids? You didn't talk with me." And that's when it like hit me. I'm like, "Oh, I'm trying to convince a lot of people who are angry with me that I'm a really good guy," all right? Around this time, if you are newer here, we transitioned from one movement into Neighborhood Church, and in that process, there was several people who were really hurt and angry, and I don't blame them, right? Like, friends with reality, when we made this transition, we hoped everyone was gonna be like, yeah! But we knew maybe, well, it turns out there was maybe some people who were very angry, and they were very vocal about it. To the point of where, like, in my head, I thought, like, people would say, hear my name, and they'd be like, oh, crusader. I don't know why they're French, but in my mind, right? They're like, oh, boo, spit on the ground, all right? And I don't like that, right? Like, if you're aware, we're going to be talking a little bit about the Enneagram. Enneagram is like this fake social science, essentially, right? That it's like a personality test. That's essentially what it is. And I'm a 3, which I'm going to talk a little bit, but I'm also a 2 wing, which means I'm a high feeler. I can walk in a room and I can, like, have the sixth sense where I can just, like, emotionally feel what people are carrying with them. And I carried people's anger with me. And again, I want to be clear. I have no problem. Everyone's entitled to feel what they need to feel. But I wanted to rescue them from that pain. Right? That's why I'm a pastor. Like, I want to help people grow and transform and evolve. And even people who are frustrated at me, I wanted to do something to, like, help them escape that pain. And something inside me, when I saw that post that says, hey, I need help, something in my brain said, hey, now you can tell everyone how good of a guy you are. You're going to prove to all those people who are those, right? You're going to prove to those French people, right? That you are a really good guy. And if maybe they can see how good of a guy you are, it'll elevate and say, oh, I don't need to be angry at Chris. I don't need to be angry because good people, really good people do these kind of things. They don't need to hurt people. And maybe they could, like, be okay and walk around town, and maybe they can go to bed. And if they can go to bed, maybe finally I could go to bed. Maybe I could sleep through the night. Maybe I don't have to carry this stress and this fear of who I'm going to bump into around Carleton or Cloquet or Duluth, right? And that is a very unhealthy way of approaching it. That is a very irrational way of saying I'm going to, like, take care of everyone else by proving I'm a good guy because it's my job to prove to everyone else I'm a good guy. That is not a healthy response. And that's because I was letting my ego make the decision, right? Your ego is very important. Your ego tells you something inside of you, tells you are important when, you are okay if, you are really special if. And it's all, like, outward focus. Your ego demands that everything around you is, like, okay, right? Your ego says that you have to be superior and you have to be separate. You have to be special. And when you let your ego drive you, you're going to do incredibly toxic things because you're going to go faster and harder to tell everyone, no, I'm really special. No, I'm really important. Look how great I am. Look how healthy I am. Look how much fun I'm having, right? This, like, social media and the ego, like, love each other, right? Because you can just tell everyone, look how pretty I am today, right? Look how important I am. Look at this, my favorite for me. Look how good of a parent I am today, right? As opposed to me playing board games with my daughter. It's like, no, get a better picture. People need to know how good of a dad I am, right? And when you let the ego drive you, it leads to really scary places. But here's the problem. In our culture, we celebrate the ego, right? We celebrate the business owner that puts in 80 hours a week and plows through employees, but they have these great big results. We say, wow, look at the self-made woman, the self-made man. We look at movie stars, we look at celebrities, and we celebrate, look how hard they're working, right? And there's nothing wrong with working hard, but when you let your ego drive, it's scary. Because the ego thrives when it mutes reality. Your ego thrives when it can mute reality. Your ego has to, like, project, has to pretend that there is nothing wrong with you, that you are okay. And any perceived threat of weakness, of slowing down, of being maybe, I don't know, having some evil things inside of you, having some broken things inside of you, your ego says, no, that cannot happen. Why? Because I need to be superior. I need to be important. This is why we have midlife crisis, right? You know, it's funny. I'm processing on stage, which you're never supposed to do. So I've been told, right? It's like, you don't hear about, like, women having midlife crises, right? It's not like they're like, hey, I went and bought a sports car and, right, like, whatever things that we categorize in. But men, we do. And the reason I believe, I'm about to turn 40, so I guess I don't feel it that much, but maybe I will later. But, like, when you're in your 20s and 30s, like, you're kicking butt and taking things, right? I almost did it again, right? You are thriving, you're succeeding, and you're feeding that ego because you're saying you're important if, you're important when, you're successful when. And so you're going, and all of a sudden, the life, instead of always being behind you, like, life becomes a little bit more on the peripherals, and you can't do what you did when you're 25, right? You can't perform, you can't eat, you can't stay out as late, you can't have that same drive from when you're 25, and then when you're 40 or 50 or 60, and all of a sudden your ego says, you can't slow down, you can't be bored,
You can't rest. You can't. Why? Because you are so important. You need to what? Have a new marriage, have a new toy, have a new car, have a new house, like lose it, right? Because your ego is saying you have to have something more. It is insatiable desire that your ego has, and it never stops. And what it breeds is something toxic. And the reality is that everyone here, just take a breath, right? There is things wrong with you, right? Some people are like, I'm sorry. We call it the shadow self, right? Richard Rohr, who helped do a lot of this Enneagram stuff, is that we all have a shadow self of our life. And your shadow is things in your life that you might be aware or not aware of that maybe don't lead to the best results. That maybe you have some selfishness in your life. Maybe you have some stubbornness. Maybe you have some sort of habits. Things that maybe you caught from your parents. You're not even aware that you are bringing with you into the room. But they produce unhealthy things. So, like, oh, I gotta get this right. It says, the shadow self is not evil in and of itself. It just allows you to do evil without recognizing it as evil, right? It's not evil that you have shortcomings, that you have tendencies, right? But it helps shape you to do evil things. And we don't, like, love looking at our faults, right? Well, maybe some of you do, right? But, all right, healthy people don't love going and looking at the shadow stuff because it costs work. And the ego says, no, don't spend your time over there. Spend your time winning. Spend your time succeeding. And this is my personality. I am a 3 on the Enneagram. And if you're not aware of the Enneagram, my wife leads a small group, really a workshop about taking you through the Enneagram. Or you can like Google it. I'd recommend the book Road Back to Yourself or Road Back to You that walks you through what the Enneagram is. You can take the test. It's fantastic. It has helped, honestly, more. I'll just use Nikki and I. It has helped Nikki and I in our relationship and even in our working relationship that we work together. We see each other all the time, right? So when we go to work, she's there. I go home, she's there, right? And she's my best friend, so I love it, but that creates friction. Having the Enneagram, she's a 1, which means just like she's like drives for perfection. And I'm a 3, which means I want to succeed at all costs. I want to win. I know. Great, great recipe, right? Because she's like, no, we have to do it right. I'm like, we just got to get it done. Let's go, right? It's just like, good enough. Move on to the next thing. And that to her is like a living hell. Like, what do you mean good enough? We need it perfect. Why am I talking about this? Oh, but the Enneagram is really positive. So I'm a 3. There's 9 different personality types. I'm a 3, which means I'm an achiever. This is like very entrepreneurial. This is why planting a church for me was like awesome. Because it's like, oh, so I get to work like 65 hours? I love it. I get to have like 100 conversations with people sharing the same vision over and over again. I love it. Like it drives me. I want to be on the move and I want to win. I want to, in my head, winning and succeeding, right? But that's not always good. And in the Enneagram, they share like the positive things, but they put in writing too, your shadow self. Things that you will just naturally lean into that if you're not aware of will hurt you and hurt other people. And when I read it, the positive stuff, I'm like, oh, that's me. That's me. When I got the negative stuff, I'm like, I don't want to read this anymore. Right? Because my shadow side of a 3 is that since I want to win, I can become a chameleon. And I was reading this, I could think back of like places in my life where I've done this, where I can, I remember, I should finish my thought. I'm a chameleon means I can change my appearance, the tone of my voice, the words I use, what I laugh at. Because when I walk in the room as a 2, I can emotionally feel it. And I can see if I do this, this, and this, I get this result. It just comes instantly to me. And if I take advantage of that, if I'm not my authentic self, then I'm using people to get a desired result, which I've heard is not a real great thing, right? And I can remember even one time getting up on a stage, this was like 10 years ago, and I heard a preacher use this tone of voice. And so I got up and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna use that tone of voice because then I will win. And as I'm doing, I'm like, what am I doing? What kind of person am I, right? But in my shadow self, I'll cut corners. I'll be a chameleon. I will take advantage of people. And the remedy to that, right, is I have to practice vulnerability. I have to practice being authentic. And that's what I've been working on for the past 5 years. Because my ego, right, my ego says, no, don't worry about being authentic. Just worry about being separate and superior. But your shadow self is there. And really, when you let your ego drive and it cannot see anything as weakness, then it closes off your shadow self. And you become a separate self. You become a separate self, a disconnected self, or a false self, right? Actually, I think that's what I even put on there. Yeah, right? Good job, Chris. So a false self, meaning you have to pretend that you're something better than you actually are. And when you do this, and when you can do this as individuals, you can do this as a circle of friends, you can do this in a family system, right, which is where you see it most often. You can see it in an organization, and you can even see it in a church, right? Fundamentalism, if you're aware of that, it means I know what's right and I know what's wrong. I know what's black, I know what's white. I know who is holy and I know who the enemy is. And fundamentalism thrives when everyone knows who's the enemy, right? That's just how it works. And when you have this idea of, no, we are great, we have all the truth, we are perfect, even a family, no, we have this is the best way of doing things, and we're all happy, and we don't talk about politics, and we don't talk about crying yourself to sleep, Dad, right? We don't talk those things, and you have firm boundaries. What often happens is you begin to resent other people who hold the same tendencies, who have the same brokenness, who have the same issues. But since you can't process it yourself because it's not allowed, because ego says, no, we're not weak, you begin to demonize other people the same thing of yourself. Classic example. Practicing vulnerability, right? When I was writing this message, I was thinking like, well, I probably have done that, right? And instantly I thought of like two or three weeks ago, someone was driving by me on the interstate and they were texting while driving. And I'm like, what are you doing? You're putting my life in jeopardy. And I'm honking the horn. I'm trying to wave them down, you know, really safe driving tactics. And I was so angry that they were doing it. And they had no idea. Like they looked at me like, this guy's losing it over there, right? And in my mind, I'm like, oh man, I better tell Nikki I just saw someone texting while driving, and I went to grab my phone while I'm driving. Right? That's a classic example that we will resent other people for doing the very same things that we have, but we just don't want to look at it and we don't want to deal with it. Why? Because we feel that if I slow down, if I'm wrong, if I have something in my life that might be less than I am weak or I'm gone. And maybe even, we might even take a little bit further and say, if I have anything in my life that could be, quote unquote, sin, then I'm not perfect. And what's God going to do with me? What are my friends, my family, what are they going to do with me? Because there's something inside, our ego tells us to win. Our ego says that we have to be strong. And what Jesus says is so radically different. Jesus never asks us to be perfect. Let's take this for example, right? Like we talk off and on, we have a class actually coming up called Whiteness 101, where we talk about privilege. In my experience, white people, especially white men, don't like talking about white privilege because it makes them feel uncomfortable. And they're like, I'm not a racist. I have a lot of friends of people of color. And they get really defensive instead of saying, we all have privilege, right? We all have it. We all have some level, right? You're not going to like, to some level, we have some racial tendencies. We have bias in our life. You can't, you have to confront it. It's there. But we like to think, nope, I don't. Why? Because if I have any kind of bias in my life, then I must be an evil person. No, you're not evil because you have bias. It's what are you going to do with it? And how are you going to grow? And how are you going to use the power or privilege that you might have? And so you can be aware of those things. And so we can help continue to elevate others, right? Instead of buying into this system that's oppressing and marginalizing people of color or LGBTQ friends, right? But we shy away from it so much because we feel insecure of that I'm a bad person. The shadow self will produce more bias in your life if you don't deal with a thing. It will produce more racist tendencies in life if you just ignore it. And what Jesus invites us into is never a life of being perfect. Never. Actually, like Jesus goes after people in a positive way, right? Jesus engages people who are set apart, that the power, the empire has said, you are less than because you were born in this part of this country. You are less than because your parents have this name. You are less than because you are sick or you're blind. And Jesus radically goes, he leaves the empire and says, go for it, have what you want. We're going to read that in a little bit. Then he goes to the tables. He goes to the party. He goes to the dance. Like, think about it. If Jesus went up to the Samaritan woman, the woman at the well, right? He walks in. And she's at the well, and she's there because she has slept with a lot of different guys, right? And she knows that people like a rabbi like Jesus is not supposed to sit with people like her, not just because of what she was doing with her body, just because of where she was born and who her parents were. And she says, hey, Jesus, you're not supposed to be with people like me. And what if Jesus said, oh, thanks for the reminder, I forgot. Yeah, you're a horrible person. And if you get that whole thing figured out, right, get perfect, get well. And then hit me up. I'm Jesus. You can look me up, right? And what does Jesus do? Jesus is not threatened. She's not excluded because she's different. She's not excluded because she has some areas in her life that she's trying to work through. Jesus doesn't say, how dare you? He says, drink of me. take me in. He invites her into this life of transformation instead of life of demonizing her. And the difference is so radically different. That's a redundant sentence, right? But it is so radically two different worlds. But where we live so often is thinking, no, I have to get it right then, and then I have to keep it right. A life of transformation is different. Actually, the time Jesus goes after people is for a totally different reason. This is Matthew 23. And if you've never read this, and you have this picture of who Jesus is in your head, and you're like, Jesus carrying on like a little, I always picture Jesus carrying like a little baby lamb, because when I was a kid, I saw a picture of Jesus holding a lamb. And he's just walking around like, hey guys, I'm Jesus. I got a lamb here. How you doing? You want some bread? Here you go. All right? And I think it's positive. Think of sweet, caring Jesus. But then you get to chapter 23 in Matthew, and Jesus loses it. And I'm only giving you like a snapshot. If you want to go back and read it, it's like blow after blow after blow. And here's what he says. This is 23 verses 25, chapter 23 verses 25 and 26 through 28. You're hopeless. Your religion, scholars and Pharisees, frauds. You burnish the surface of your cups and bowls so they sparkle in the sun, while the insides are maggoty and you maggoty with your greed and gluttony. Thanks, Jesus. Stupid Pharisee, scour the insides and then the gleaming surface will mean something. You're hopeless, you religion, scholars and Pharisees, you frauds. You're like the manicured grave plots, grass clipped and the flowers bright, but 6 feet down it's all rotting bones and worm-eaten flesh. People look at you and you think you're saints, but beneath the skin, you're total frauds. Like, he does this like seven more times. I was just talking with Micah. Why? Why does Jesus at this time and this space to those people, why does he lose it? Jesus has like a lot of opportunities to look at something wrong with the world or evil with the empire, whatever it may, and he moves with this love and this grace. But here, Jesus comes strong at the Pharisees, right? Why? The word that they use in different translations is hypocrites. And hypocrites, we're all aware of, like a hypocrite was like a professional actor, like would have this mask. They could be the one person, play multiple different roles. And what is it about Jesus, which again, Jesus is the face of God, a benevolent God, a good and beautiful God. What is it about God that gets angry at that? And here's my interpretation, is that any time that we let the ego, right? Because the Pharisees, religious, the frauds, is an egocentric self. Anytime we let the ego drive and saying, no, we have to perform, we have to play, we have to ignore, we have to exclude, right? We only include who gives us power, right? Anytime we do that, where we draw the lines of what is sacred and what is not, of what is evil and what is truth, of what is right and what is wrong, and we use that to exclude or oppress or marginalize other people at the so that we're okay, that is sin. That is not where the kingdom of God lives. And when you do that and then you hold other people out, you hold other people down, and where they're like, I guess I am less than. I guess I can't move in. I guess I can't step into this flow with the divine. Why? Because I'm less than, I'm different. They're telling me I'm wrong. And I have to be like them. I have to look like them. I have to act like them. I have to behave like them. Anytime you create a system that intentionally excludes others, God is saying, that is not who I am. That is not what this God looks like. That is not what this God does. Why? Because this God is a benevolent, loving God. And anytime we oppress, I mean, look at the story of the Old Testament. Look at the story of the Israelites. Anytime they get oppressed, God sends a prophet. God sends them and they lead them out. And they're like, this is amazing. And then they oppress other people. And then a country comes and oppresses them. They're like, what's going on? They can't understand. Anytime we take advantage, oppress, marginalize people, God is saying, I'm with those people you're marginalizing. You want to find out where the kingdom of God is? Go hang out with the people who are being oppressed, because that's where Jesus lives. And anytime we do that, God is saying, you fraud. But this is hard, right? Because we want to appear perfect. And we even see in the life of Jesus himself. This is in John chapter 20, and this is where I end. In John chapter 20, Jesus died. He's resurrected. He's in resurrected life, which resurrected life is our model. It's our picture of what it looks like to be in the kingdom, to be a kingdom person, to be a Jesus-looking person, is to do what he did, right? And follow in Jesus' footsteps, but also to be a resurrected person. And it's funny. Jesus walks up, or there's these disciples, and Thomas, they call him Doubting Thomas. He had to carry that stigma for eons, right? So could have been better, like something like super good-looking Thomas would have been better, yeah. That joke didn't work, so. Doubting Thomas, and the reason is because he says in John chapter 20 with his friends, they're like, hey, Thomas, hey, Jesus is back. it's super cool. And he's like, I don't believe you. They're like, what? He's like, I don't believe you. I think you guys are lying. They're like, well, what could we do to convince you? I have to be able to see him, and I have to be able to see like the holes in his hands. I got to see the scars. And it's like Jesus heard that. He's like, okay. And they're in this locked room, and Jesus walks through the locked door, like doesn't pick it and then open it, right? Like walks through it because he's Jesus, right? And it's like he's calling his bluff. And this is what we read in John chapter 20. Then Jesus said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. And Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. So we use this story as a way of saying, like, Jesus had a gotcha moment with Thomas. I won't believe until I see. And Jesus says, okay, now you see. And Thomas responds with worship. You're now my Lord and you're my God. But there's something so much bigger here. Like, if you elevate it, something different, something bigger than just like proof. What we see in a resurrected Christ is that Jesus has wounds. Jesus has scars. Jesus has an exposed side. And when we think about heaven, resurrected life, heaven, when we think about resurrected Jesus, at least in my mind, maybe you're different. This is why this verse is so compelling to me, is we think of perfect Jesus, like perfectly pressed gowns or robes or whatever he wore, right? Jesus wore a gown. I like that. All right. Like perfectly pressed robes and perfect Birkenstock sandals and perfect mustache and white teeth. And he's like, hey, guys, baby lambing him. Hey, guys, I'm Jesus. And we think because it's perfect, then it's good. Because it's perfect, then it's holy. Because it's perfect, then it is sacred. And that's not at all what happened. Jesus has scars that bore that he died. Jesus has a wound that says that he lost. Because when he dies, his followers, his like people were like, this is going to be great. He's Messiah. Oh, he's getting beat up. Oh, he's bleeding. Do gods bleed? Oh, he's being beaten again. What should we do? I don't know. And what point is he going to stand up and fight back? Because that's what gods do. Oh, now he's up on the cross with common criminals. Our Messiah is just a criminal and he dies? Gods don't die. What do? They run and they hide. And Jesus comes back, resurrected life, with those same scars that tell of a story what was once happened. And that is not a threat to heaven. That Jesus had wounds. He lived a perfect life, but perfection. We think of holiness as a lack of something. And that's good. Holiness is a lack of something good. Like I need to swear less. Not me. I need to be selfish less. I need to have less of this addiction or whatever. We think of, if I can just get less, then there's holiness. But holiness is that you step into the fullness of something, not just a lack of something. And that's what Jesus did. With a wound, with holes in his hands, he is in the fullness of this benevolent God. He's in the fullness of this good God, in the fullness of this hope and this joy and this life. He's in that flow, even with imperfection. And I end here because of this. The reason why this is orthodox, maybe even thinking that, when does he even tie that word in, is that something that's tried and true is that we are transformed people. As followers of Jesus, we are transformed people, and we're never being done transforming. We're transformed people who are always transforming, that we are going to work on our shadow self. We're going to take time. This is why I love the Enneagram. This is why I love sitting around tables with my friends and laughing and then crying. This is why I love Dr. Hutchinson, my general practitioner. This is why I love Dr. Heather, my therapist, because I can continually be transformed by being honest, by being vulnerable, by being real. Knowing I have things in my life as a father, as a friend, as a husband, as a pastor, that I can grow in. And when we don't hold on to that tried and true, that if that's not a pillar that we stand on, that we're always going to be transforming, then what we are producing is some religious toxic stuff of saying, you are good enough now. You have all the right information. You have all the right answers. And where I want to live and where why Christianity has been able to survive so long is even when we make mistakes, even when we hurt our daughter, even when we say the stupid thing, Jesus never says, get off my island. Jesus says, drink of me, because you are transforming and I'm here with you always. Yeah, the ego tells you there's a better version of you just around the corner. And you get to that corner and the ego says, oh, no, just a little more, just a little more. And some of you here, this is you. You hold yourself to this standard. You hold yourself to this expectation of perfection. And whatever that standard is, whatever perfect looks like for you, and it's killing you. It is drawing the life out of you, and you're ready to kind of just give up. And for some of you, you might just think, yeah, this is just as good as it's ever going to be. That is a lie. And so my invitation to you is two things. Can I have the ministry team come up, actually? I'll explain. The ministry team are just people who are going to have the chance if you want to respond to one of these things. Two things that I feel like could be for us today. First one is this. You've held yourself back because of the scars. You've held yourself back from a relationship, from the divine, from pursuing something, thinking, if people know that I'm not perfect, if people know what I've said or what I've done, what I haven't said, what I haven't done, that I will be excluded or less than. And I just felt like some of you here, maybe you're ready to break out of that. And the second thing is this. You've been performing out of fear and being rejected. And I love this word. This is like such a churchy word, but it's so life-giving. Is maybe it's time to confess. And that is a threatening word. It's threatening when we let our ego drive, because confessing is putting words to what the reality is. It's saying, I have a problem. I have an issue. I have pain. Help. That's all confession is. So I'm going to pray here in a little bit. And if either of those things or anything else impacted you, the people up here would love to pray with you. And what confession looks like, it is such an orthodox, beautiful tradition. As you walk up, the people up here, it's all confidential. They're not going to like counsel you, right? They're like, oh, let me take some notes for you. They're going to you walk up and say, hey, I'd like to confess. They're going to hear it. They're going to put their hand on you. And then they're going to pray to ask that God would come and bring life and bring healing and restoration and transformation. So let's pray. So God, I thank you that you see us. I thank you that you know us and how you are radically pursuing us even now. So I pray for my friends who are here, where that egocentric self, where they feel exhausted from trying to convince everyone that they're a really good person. My friends who here today who just can't wait for the other corner, and that maybe the best self is like now, not later, and how there can be life and contentment and breath in this space, not just the next one. So you give us what we need to be able to at least acknowledge the shadow self. And I pray you would give us tools and highlight people where we can practice being authentic. We can practice confessing. We can practice exploring what are those things in the shadow self instead of denying them. And I pray you'd give us confidence, Father, that we are deeply loved. As we are transformed and as we are transforming, we are deeply, deeply loved. So be with us in your name. Amen. So, the people up here, if you'd like prayer for anything, one of those things I mentioned, they'd love to pray for you. Steve's going to lead us in some more worship, and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.